next argued case is number 21-1469, System Studies and Simulation against the United States. Okay, Mr. English, when you're ready.
Good morning, and may it please the court. This court should reverse the Court of Federal Claims judgment in this case for three reasons. First, the Court of Federal Claims has interpreted this court's bid protest precedent to recognize a presumption of prejudice in cases where the government acts arbitrarily and capriciously or without a rational basis. The Court of Federal Claims erred by failing to apply that.
Irrespective of how the various Court of Claims opinions in the past may have interpreted stuff that we said in the past, what do you do with clear statements that we have made, such as in Glenn Defense, where we say you need to show prejudicial error even in the face of a finding of arbitrary action? Those are our precedents that we have to follow. How do we find for you on that question where that case, I mean, unless you disagree and can explain to me why, that case says you need to show prejudicial error, not, you know, in the face even of arbitrary action?
Sure, Your Honor. For every Glenn defense, there's an Impreza, there's an Emory Worldwide. This year, we've got Veterans for Life. And so the conundrum at the Court of Claims comes from its interpretation of Impreza and Emory Worldwide, which I believe were decided in 2001. And in those cases, this court articulated the protester's burden in a disjunctive fashion. The protester can prove arbitrary and irrational action, ground one, or prove a prejudicial violation of statute or regulation, ground two. And in those cases, the court said, when the protester makes a challenge...
When you say the court, you mean the Court of Federal Claims?
No, Your Honor. I mean this court.
In what case?
Impreza, and I can't say the rest of that court, that case name, from 2001. I can give Your Honor a cite.
I read Impreza. I know you cited it. And Impreza simply states that a procurement may be sent aside if the award lacked a rational basis. Of course, that's true. Impreza didn't discuss prejudice one way or the other, did it?
It didn't discuss prejudice, and I would concede that there's not a case where this court has articulated a presumption of prejudice. What the conundrum at the Court of Claims, and for practitioners there, is there is a strong line of cases, which I recognize are not binding on this court, where various Court of Claims judges apply this presumption, and it comes from that bifurcated standard that we see in Impreza, not a discussion of prejudice per se, but the discussion about the substantial chance test and where that comes into play in a protester's burden of proof has only been applied, at least in Impreza, as articulated, on the second prong, when the challenge is made on the ground of a violation of law. That carries forward to Emory Worldwide. We see it again in Syntec, I believe, in 2009. The same year, we see the Labatt case from this court, which articulates the standard as we see it in Glenn Defense Marine, or Glenn Defense. And so we've got this...
I guess what I'm hearing from you, so tell me if I'm wrong, that there may or may not, but I'm hearing you tell us there's at least, at a minimum, there's confusion at the Court of Federal Claims. Obviously, the Court of Federal Claims here wasn't confused and thought that the standard was Glenn, which is our case. I still am asking you to look at Glenn, to look at the statements we've made, not the Court of Federal Claims or their interpretation of what we may or may not have said, and tell me how we can get around our precedent, which separates the two and doesn't require an automatic presumption of prejudice in light of arbitrary action.
I don't know that there is a way around it, Your Honor. I think we need a clear statement on that. And so I would disagree respectfully that the Court of Claims wasn't confused. The same judge at the Court of Claims in within 12 months of deciding our case had applied a presumption of prejudice in the HVF West case and something in another case I can't remember.
Well, I can't respond to that. I don't know what context was. Sure. Obviously, you can presume prejudice.
And so our point is there is a confusion at the Court of Federal Claims as to how to interpret the various pronouncements the court has made on prejudice. And
what do you think Glenn is confusing about the Glenn case?
I don't think anything is confusing about
it. So in that case, we answered in a way in the contrary to what you're arguing here.
I certainly agree.
Okay, so how did we as a panel go against a pronouncement we had in one of our presidential opinions? That was presidential, wasn't it?
I believe it was, Your Honor.
Yeah.
And so I don't think the court has ever spoken directly as to whether there is a presumption or not. I don't think the presumption itself, if it exists, is necessarily contrary to the rule of prejudicial error, right? Because the rule of prejudicial error would just say that the Court of Federal Claims has to consider whether an error is harmless before it sets aside an agency's action. Whereas a presumption is an evidentiary convention, they'll essentially say who speaks first on that point. If there's irrational action, then presumably the presumption would be rebuttable. And the court would take account of the rule of prejudicial error as part of the rebuttal analysis that would necessarily go forward. If the error was a violation of law, then it would be the protester's burden in the first instance to prove prejudice by meeting the substantial chance standard.
So viewing the matter that way, how could that possibly make a difference in this case where, regardless of who spoke first, the Court of Federal Claims went through the particulars and said this could not possibly have changed the result?
Well, I think the Court of Federal Claims in the reconsideration opinion says that the presumption exists. I mean, she recognized that there is a presumption, but said that in order to get the presumption, you have to prove prejudice. As opposed to dealing with that in a rebuttal situation. And there was no evidence offered by the government or the intervener from a rebuttal standpoint. But we think there's prejudice irrespective of the presumption. We've highlighted that only because there were contemporaneous cases where protesters got the benefit of it, and we didn't.
Is the teeny bit of confidential information here confidential at your behest or at somebody else's behest?
I believe it's at the intervener's behest. The actual description of the strength is the thing specifically that I realize is confidential, or called being confidential.
It's not yours.
It's not ours, Your Honor. No. But that strength, which I won't describe in open court, carried with it an expectation that the government would have these substantial cost savings. That was something that was the subject of great discussion amongst the evaluation team. We see the emails where some members of the evaluation team thought that savings would make up the entire price premium. And here, S-Cubed is the highest rated offeror across all evaluation factors, and it has a substantial cost savings benefit to the government because its price is a lot lower. And so we have a situation, irrespective of the presumption, where one of four strengths, this strength that we can't say out loud in open court, was one that the SSA expressly relied on. It was a strength of the staffing factor that...
Well, let me ask you, since we're not talking about specifics here, but just let me ask you, do you agree that... under what standard do we review the court's analysis and conclusions with respect to those questions? Substantial evidence review?
Clear error, Your Honor. The standard that would apply to the court's determination as to whether there was prejudice or not, I believe, is the clearly erroneous standard. And where we think it was clearly erroneous is because the SSA specifically said there are four things, and this was under one of four non-price evaluation factors. There were four things that CAE offered that make me decide I want to award this contract to CAE. And she specifically relied on all four of them, including this strength and expressly the substantial cost savings benefit that the government believed carried with it. And so the problem is there was no way for the Court of Federal Claims to go and weight those relative strengths when the SSA didn't do it herself. What the court said was, the Court of Federal Claims, was that because there was no discussion about this particular strength and the cost savings benefit as part of the price analysis, that shows that it didn't really factor into the decision. The problem is the SSA said it did expressly multiple times. And so there was no way for the court, in the first instance to predict how that was going to shake out. Just because there was no discussion of this strength at the price stage, because for many reasons, but primarily because the reason the Court of Federal Claims found this strength irrational in the first place was because the price, the cost savings tied to CLIN 4, I believe it was, which was a plug number. It was a $100,000 plug number. And if you didn't bid it, the government put the $100,000 into your proposal. So everybody bid the same thing. If the SSA had tried to adjust the price on the, with these cost savings benefits that it, she clearly expected, at CLIN 4, it would have been doubly irrational because there was a limit to what CLIN 4 could do. And so we see the Court of Federal Claims decision there as is sort of circular. The reason it's prejudicial, or excuse me, the reason the court found that this strength was irrational was because CLIN 4 was capped and there's no way to find a substantial cost savings benefit. But then the reason it didn't matter was because there was no discussion of the cost savings benefit as it relates to this this capped CLIN. And so we have a situation, and I'm not aware of another case in government contracting where there's actually been a finding of an irrational evaluation decision and on a case this close. And we have WellPoint and others where it's not close, or the Oracle case. But we actually have the higher rated, lower cost offeror, and the Court of Federal Claims impedes into the weighting of strengths behind a specific non-price evaluation factor and makes a forecasted judgment in a case this close. And that's where, in our view, the Court of Claims really went awry, regardless of whether there's a presumption, is to make that decision in the first instance. That's part of the SSA's business proposition. That's a decision that she has to make. And we think once the Court of Federal Claims found that the SSA, not just that the technical evaluation team assigned an irrational strength, but that the SSA specifically and expressly relied on it, that would require the Court of Federal Claims to send that decision back to the SSA to get a decision in the first instance as to whether that's still the value proposition the government wants. Because this unarticulated cost savings benefit that the government expected but's not quantified, there's no way for the Court of Federal Claims to understand in the first instance how the government viewed that. It could have viewed CAE's proposal as essentially cost neutral. It could get the three other strengths that it offered, plus it could get this one that potentially, in the view of some people on the government's evaluation team, completely negated the price premium. And so we need that decision in the first instance from the SSA and not from the Court of Claims, and that is where the clear error arises. Again, regardless of the presumption, that is where we see the clear error coming from the Court of Claims in our view. I think I'm into my rebuttal time, so if there are no questions, I'll stop there.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Now, my notes here say the other side is appearing by video. Please tell us who you are.
Yes, Your Honor. This is Evan Wisser for the United States, and we actually have the defendant intervener, CAE's counsel, is present as well. We're going to allocate 2 minutes of our argument time to them,
okay?
And they're going to address specifically the issue of potential waiver or forfeiture of the prejudice presumption argument before this court. But I will address all the other remaining issues in the case.
Okay.
May it please the court, we ask that this court affirm the trial court's factual finding that there was no prejudice resulting from the Army's erroneous evaluation of the procurement strength that it had identified. The trial court, consistent with the instructions from this court, made a full and complete evaluation of the administrative record, determined what the reasonable likelihood of the result would have been absent the evaluation error, and made a factual finding that in this case, the agency's decision would not have changed. And in particular, I want to highlight that the trial court followed very closely the guidance that this court issued pretty recently in the Oracle decision in how the trial court is supposed to evaluate prejudice, what sorts of standards of review apply, and came to that same conclusion that this court applied in Oracle, which is where there is evidence in the record that provides a reasonable, or that does not provide a reasonable likelihood that the result would have been different, it is within the scope of the trial court's discretion in making factual findings from the record to say that the award decision would have been the same, and that's exactly what the trial court did here. I want to first address the presumption of prejudice. I don't know that it should be a substantial issue in this case, as I think the court has recognized Glenn Defense Marine appears to address that question. To the extent there is any remaining confusion at the Court of Federal Claims level, we would echo the request from S3 to provide a clear statement. I think the court did provide that clear statement in the DynCorp opinion from just a couple months ago. We submitted a Rule 28J letter notifying the court of that decision. We also referenced it in our briefing. I think the issue there is that because the prejudice analysis in DynCorp was a secondary consideration, the court didn't reach it. The court affirmed there were no procurement errors, and so the holding itself did not reach the issue of prejudice. But the court did make a footnote that appeared to be in direct response to the
briefing.
Well,
why don't you get to the part that the other side was arguing this morning is none of that matters. We don't care about what standard you apply or what presumption. We ought to win, or at least we have established clear error on these facts in this record.
Certainly, Your Honor. And applying the clear error standard, the rule that originated the instruction from this court about how to determine prejudice started from Bannum in 2005. And that is to say that the trial court is to take a trial on the record, essentially, from the administrative record, make factual findings in the first instance, not be as deferential to the decisions of the agency as it is in the APA standard, the arbitrary capricious standard, because the trial court is the first tribunal to assess prejudice. That's what Bannum said, that there would have been no reason for the agency to make a determination in the first instance to say, well, how would this decision have come out differently if some error were obtained? So what Bannum instructed the trial court to do, and that this court reaffirmed in Oracle, is to say, look at the entire scope of evidence in the record, and if it is possible to discern how this would have resulted differently, to make that determination. And I think really the core dispute here between the parties is that S3 is pointing to some of the evidence in the SSA's decision where the SSA did list out the four strengths at issue here. But S3 ignores what we pointed out at the trial court and before this court and what the trial court ultimately relied on, which was the summation of the SSA's decision. If you look at Appendix 14873, and I think it's the last paragraph of 14872 and then carries over into 14873, after reciting the four strengths and providing the explanation from the SSA as to why those strengths were reasonably provided to CAE, the SSA then provides the condensed trade-off analysis, where she says, the core concern we have here is the staffing capabilities of the contractor. And that relates back to the solicitation language. It relates back even further to some of the pre-solicitation discussions the Army had. The real problem the Army had in providing these helicopter training services was lack of available staffing and the contractor's inability to provide sufficient staffing for the contract. That is the Army's paramount concern. And the SSA proceeds to explain that it is CAE's strengths which specifically address that concern. And it's that attribute of CAE's proposal, its ability to meet the staffing requirements of the Army, that is what justifies the price premium and makes the trade-off beneficial to the government to pay more for the staffing benefits that CAE's proposal provides. Now, she doesn't break down in more detail what she means about the staffing benefits, but it's fairly easy to discern that the strength at issue here has nothing to do with staffing. It's a billing proposal. It simply would allocate how the payments to CAE would be structured under certain circumstances. That has nothing to do with how many FTEs CAE is providing, what level of training it's providing to its staff, any of those issues. So this is really just a disagreement about which part of the SSA's analysis matters more. We both presented our positions. We both presented our view of the evidence to the trial court, and the trial court, within its sound discretion, made a finding of fact. It found that the summation that we pointed to, backed up by the references we provided to the solicitation and the other discussions that the agency had, was enough of a record for the trial court to determine that, yes, the agency's decision was rooted mostly in the staffing factors. And so this particular strength relating to a billing item would not have changed that trade-off analysis, that was clear enough from the record for the court to make that finding. And the other point I would make is I know that counsel for S3 referenced some circularity potentially in the trial court's decision. I think it's really S3's argument that ends up being circular here, because what the trial court said, one of the main reasons why this particular strength was erroneously given, had no rational basis, is because, in large part, that it didn't really play into the trade-off analysis. As I said, it was a proposal that related to the billing practices, yet it had absolutely no presence in the price evaluation. And the trial court correctly noted that if this was a substantial element of the trade-off analysis, as a billing proposal, you would expect to see some sort of variation, even a contingent variation, in the price analysis as part of the SSA's discussion. That was completely absent. And also, even though it was allocated as a strength under the technical factors, because of the nature of the strength, it was hypothetical in application, and it had no relevance to CAE's capability to perform or how much staffing it was being able to dedicate to the contract. And that is all clearly stated in the SSA's decision. She does not provide any explanation as to how this particular proposal that related to billing would have impacted the technical side of their capabilities. So it was because of the fact that this strength, despite being described as a strength, when you looked at the trade-off analysis, did not actually enter the picture in the discussion of the trade-offs, the specific trade-offs of technical strength and staffing levels versus the price premium on either side of that balancing scale. Anything related to this particular strength was absent. And that was in large part not only the basis for the court's determination that the harm was not prejudicial, that was a large part of the reason why the court determined the strength was erroneously given in the first place. Because the court determined that had it been something the agency truly believed to be material to the success of the contractor, it would have been mentioned in the bottom line summation of the SSA's evaluation, and it was not. So that's where I think S3's argument sort of turns in on itself. They argued successfully and prevailed in the trial court in explaining why this strength was really irrelevant and did not deserve a strength in the evaluation process. The trial court agreed and specifically emphasized the fact that it was not present to a large degree in the trade-off analysis. Now S3 wants to turn that around and say, well, because it was an erroneous strength, necessarily the trade-off analysis was irrational. But I think the particular findings that the court made reject that argument wholesale. And at least there's been no presentation from S3 that that analysis of the trial court was clearly erroneous by any means. The one thing I do want to emphasize as well, and this goes to some of the argument that S3 made about the trial court not substituting its judgment for the agency, which is a phrase that this court and the Court of Federal Claims uses from time to time. But that is meant to be a restraining impulse when conducting the APA review. That when the trial court is reviewing under the arbitrary capricious standard, it should hold its hand and not substitute its judgment for the agency unless the decision of the agency is contrary to law or truly arbitrary and capricious. That standard about not substituting judgment for the agency has never been applied in a prejudice analysis, and it makes no sense to apply in the prejudice analysis the way that S3 is arguing for here, because it would turn that restraining principle into an offensive principle that would sort of seek out and reverse agency decisions when it may not be necessary. Applying that same general principle that the court should attempt to preserve the decisions, and this comes right out of the APA, it's why the rule of prejudicial error is applied in the first place, but the court should preserve the agency decisions as much as possible unless there is truly a good reason not to. That same underlying principle, when applied to the prejudice analysis, results in the outcome that the trial court came up with here, which is where there is evidence in the record, where the SSA made a fairly clear statement of summation that this particular procurement strength had no basis on the bottom line trade-off, there is no reason to send it back. It would just be an exercise in having the SSA restate what she essentially stated the first time, and the court should not make the agency waste resources to do that. So unless the court has any questions at this point, I will yield to my counsel for the other argument.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Worcester. Mr. Ginsburg.
Your Honors. Alex Ginsberg for CAA USA. I agree with the government's position, and our arguments are well laid out in our brief. I want to take just a moment to address an ancillary but potentially dispositive issue here, which is that S3 should be stopped from arguing the existence of any presumption of prejudice when it specifically urged the trial court to apply the substantial chance standard during its arguments. S3 advocated for the substantial chance test in its motion for judgment, and that's Appendix 193 to 194, in its reply in support of its motion for judgment, which is Appendix 317. There was no mention of any presumption of prejudice until appellant's motion for reconsideration, Appendix 424 to 25. As this court noted in Key Pharmaceuticals v. Hercon Lab, 161 F3rd 709, quote, ordinarily doctrines of estoppel, waiver, invited error, or the like would prohibit a party from asserting as error a position that it advocated for at trial.
Are you saying you had no opportunity to respond to that argument, or are you just saying they should be stopped on principle?
Your Honor, at the trial level, the government and the intervener had no opportunity to respond because there was no argument about a presumption of prejudice advanced, if that answers your question. So we have addressed the issue in our briefs before this court, but not at the trial level. And to note the other quote I wanted to mention from Key Pharmaceuticals, quote, the impropriety of asserting a position which the trial court adopts and then complaining about it on appeal should be obvious on its face. And I think those words are well taken here. Appellant's primary argument against the application of waiver or estoppel is that the presumption of prejudice applies as a matter of law and cannot be waived. But the cases appellant relies on for that proposition were cases where the appellant failed to object to the trial court's application of a legal standard, not where the appellant expressly advocated for the standard it later alleged was erroneous. And they cite Myco Industries 955 F3rd 1. But again, that case does not involve one where there was an express advocacy for a proposition later declared to be erroneous. Appellant also argued in its brief that judicial estoppel does not apply because appellant, quote, achieved no success by advocating for the substantial chance test in its briefs. And they have a case on that principle. But appellant misinterprets what it means to, quote, achieve success in this context. Appellant succeeded because the trial court, in fact, applied the substantial chance test just as appellant advocated. To achieve success in this context does not mean that appellant had to win on the merits of its case. If that were so, then the doctrine of judicial estoppel essentially would have no purpose because a party such as the appellant would have no cause to assert error by the trial court nor to appeal. And those were the limited points I wanted to make, Your Honors, and otherwise we rest on our brief.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. English, you have some rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just briefly, as it relates to the waiver argument, our point as it relates to the presumption, and we highlighted it because I do think it's something that needs real clarity from this court. If it is a thing, it should have applied in this case. If there is a presumption, the presumption would have applied to relieve S3 of any burden to make a showing in the first instance. So I don't know how we waive the failure to make a showing if the presumption relieved us of the obligation to make that showing. And certainly the Court of Federal Claims addressed the presumption at length in its reconsideration decision. But I want to turn and spend the last couple of minutes talking about the issue of prejudice. And of course, with or without, if there is not a presumption, then it's the substantial chance test. And the information solutions case and the standard communications case that we cited, granted there from the Court of Claims, say that in the context of a trade-off decision, you show a substantial chance of success if your chances increase. And here there are four unique identified strengths that under one technical subfactor that tip the award to CAE. And the Court of Federal Claims said one of the four legs of a stool, one of them is irrational. And the Court of Federal Claims said there's still no prejudice. Certainly, we have a situation where our chances of award increase. We are the highest rated offeror overall. We have a substantial price savings that we've offered. One of four strengths is removed. I don't think the number is under seal. That would give us two fewer strengths under that one sub-factor than CAE, and it would only give CAE one more strength than L3 DOS, which had an even greater price savings. And so just to tie this off, I look at page 14823 of the administrative record. That's the email between members of the evaluation team, the government source selection team, where they say, and I won't read the precise number, but some number of millions of dollars price premium, and there they're talking about L3 DOS's price premium, which is even greater, could be made up over the 7 years because of this one strength. The Court of Federal Claims said that the SSA relied on it. There's nothing in the record from which the Court of Federal Claims could then say, but not really. And that's essentially what we have here, is it turns into essentially mind reading. It's irrational on its face, according to the Court of Federal Claims, that it was irrational for the SSA to rely on it. She said both of those things, but then the Court of Federal Claims said it didn't matter and she didn't really rely on it because there's not a discussion here. That, in our view,
I'm not sure the Court of Federal Claims said that the SSA didn't really rely on it. I think the Court of Federal Claims, conducting the normal harmless error prejudice inquiry, asked, take that out. Is there any reasonable chance the result wouldn't have been different? And when I read the record, what strikes me, the Court of Federal Claims saying, is that the staffing, not the billing, was the key to deciding to award to CAE, notwithstanding any difference in dollars.
Certainly, Your Honor. But remember, it's a best value trade-off decision. And S3 had outstanding marks on the staffing factor, too. It also got outstanding. And so the question then becomes that value judgment. We know that this strength carried with it, this irrational strength carried with it, some amount of cost savings benefit that the government was clearly expecting. Maybe it would make up the entire price premium. And so when we strip that out, it's the SSA's decision to say, okay, well, these staffing benefits that we get with CAE, even though now we know we're not going to get this cost savings that might make up the entire premium, it's still worth it. That's the SSA's decision to make. And that's the decision that the Court of Federal Claims made for the SSA in this case, and that is where the clear error lies. I think I've overrun my time, Your Honor. So I'll stop there unless there's any further questions.
Thank you. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under submission.